Hey guys, so Danielle isn't actually a real person. We've been meaning to have her on the pod, and like I saw a tweet that she was like, "I'm trying to get on more podcasts." I'm like, "Wait, why have you not been on our podcast yet?" So yeah, she's not really a real person because she's only been out of college for 3 years, and not even yet, like she'll be coming up on 3 years in May, and she's already a founder of a media company, the only female MRMC. How do I say that? Is that it?
Yeah. She
Okay.
yeah. The only
Yeah.
female, the only person, the only woman who operates a specific kind of camera in the entire world.
In
Like in
the
the world.
world.
Like the whole, like all of it.
Yeah. Has directed creative for Snapchat, Invisalign, Adidas, Tampax, Vicks, and more. Does all of the creative for Dave Gerhart, you know, that
Right
small
guy.
name in our community, private community for over 2,000 of us. And then it's just like also a former Broadway playwright. So,
It's just like you, yeah. So she's like super boring and has nothing to talk about and nothing to teach us. And we didn't really talk about anything. We
had
had
nothing to talk to her about,
nothing to
clearly.
say to each other. So Danielle and I actually met when we were both working at Drift. She was still in college, but was doing video for the Drift brand and essentially was there when like Drift was really defining its voice. And especially over video, she just made some really dope shit. And we've been keeping up ever since. And it's just like a literal joy to see Danielle. And I've been able to watch her try to go in-house, absolutely hate it, start her own business, flex her creative muscle, making just actual literal art. So enjoy this conversation. We were pumped to talk to her, and she just spits fire. Enjoy.
All right. Well, tell us a little bit about you and your history. Obviously, we know you a little bit, but how you became a founder at 24.
It all started by accident. All the things happened by accident. I was working at Drift. I was their like first video intern, the end of my junior year of college. Again, I also got that job totally by accident. I wanted to have an internship in film or theater. And what happened was they were all in New York or LA and none of them paid. And I was like, okay, I need something creative, but I need something that will also pay money. And so I came across Drift and was like, yeah, this seems cool. And I ended up really loving it so much, long story short, that I ended up staying there my senior year, basically full time. And from that point on, a couple of people in the B2B space had started to see my work through Drift. And so people started reaching out and said, hey, like I've seen your work from Drift. Do you do this on a freelance basis? And I had never really thought about that. So I was like, oh yeah, you know what? I guess I could do that. Sure. And so then I started doing some freelance work. But in the meantime, at the time I wasn't really like thinking even about starting my own company. And so I went back to New York after I graduated and worked as the director of marketing at a production company in New York City. And I absolutely hated it because what I found is that all these big production companies, they make really pretty videos and have zero concept of what marketing strategy is. And so the videos are really nice, but they do absolutely nothing for the client. And then on the flip side, right, working with agencies, the agencies would make these really nice looking decks with great strategy, but then like they would have no deliverables. And then the companies would have to go and like find people to do it. And so I really wasn't loving working at a production company, and the inquiries because of what the stuff that I'd done at Drift kept coming in, that it got to a point where it almost didn't make sense to just not start my own thing because there was just such a need for a company that understood both high quality production and storytelling and actual video and marketing strategy that I just was like, okay, I guess with the amount of people that are asking, I'm just going to start a thing. And I literally like was scrolling through one of those logo and company name websites and like thought Epic sounded cool and picked it in 5 minutes and sort of ran with it. And then the brand itself has evolved a lot. But
Yeah.
yeah, that's sort of how I started, totally on accident.
That's like the epitome of the intern being your boss one day because like lit because literally you did it.
Yeah. And I love that you just like found a hole that you not even I don't know. I think for me, if I had been that sort of, I'd be like, well, I don't know anything, but like that didn't exist. Like what you were building didn't exist already. So you didn't have to, right? It was like, okay, cool. I think that this would be useful. So I'm just going to go do that. Not a lot of people would do that. So like, congrats.
No, people were asking. So and that's I get a lot of questions too from people about like, oh, how do you start your own in agencies, especially like everyone wants to start an agency. And they're like, how do you do it? How do you start your own agency? And my answer is usually don't. Do a bunch of work for people and see if there's a need for it, and make sure you're actually an expert in something first, and make sure that it's niche and useful and not just because you want to do it. And then once you see that the demand is there, then quit your job and start the agency. Like, I didn't just quit and like start something new. Like, the demand was there. It's not as I'm going to just start something and it's going to be amazing. It's not like as sexy and glamorous as everyone as like the stories seem to be.
Well, you're sexy and glamorous though, so that's all that matters.
So I mean, we're sold. So I think it's super interesting because you started with B2B companies, but you have this extra layer of understanding fundamental and advanced, I don't even know if there's such thing as like advanced marketing strategy. Yeah, or philosophy or whatever, but like, you're not just like, yeah, 4 P's, I got it, I know marketing. You like actually work with people who talk about marketing on a regular basis. But how does that work sort of translate into consumer, and like, how do you kind of take your experience and translate it based off of how you're pitching yourself, essentially? Like, for anyone who also wants to like change their resume for every job that they apply to, basically, like, how do you take your B2B work and make it sound super appealing so that you can gain clients like Adidas, Snapchat, and Tampax? Because yeah, so that seems like wizardry.
So the funny thing is, I don't really talk to the like Snapchat and Adidas and Tampax about the B2B stuff so much. I think having that B2B background is super important because basically it helps me understand what's going on internally there. And so having worked on a marketing team, I know, okay, here's what this looks like. Here's what they're trying to do. They have company goals. This is just part of that bigger picture in terms of their marketing. And so I think having that background, especially coming from B2B, that's really what I think they like about working with Epic, is that we can think like they do, mm-hmm. but then also add that video layer on top of it. And then from a B2B standpoint, the B2B clients love hearing that we work with Adidas and Snapchat, right? Because they all now want to, all of a sudden they're like, oh, we need to be more interesting because we're really boring. And so that's been starting, especially this year, like that's starting to become like the most common thing. It's like everyone wants that comedic style brand video and you need it. It performs well.
No, that's interesting that your experience in both. I think we, a lot of times in general, like Sarah was saying, with resumes specifically, even like we look at the job description, we try to make our experience match exactly that, when like there are ways to use the actual experience that you have, whatever it is, and make more of a well-rounded person. Because you're right, every B2B brand wants to be more B2C. Every B2C brand actually wants you to think about how it impacts their business instead of just their customers.
Yeah, they don't want you to think like a TikToker. They want you to think like a marketer.
Yeah. Right? Oh, tweet that.
Okay.
That's good.
Thank you.
No, but I like that because I think that's where I mean, we're getting super deep into like the marketing B2B stuff, but I think that's where B2B companies just like don't get it yet, where it's like, no, you shouldn't hire a TikTok specialist to run your video strategy.
Do
like,
not.
Like, you shouldn't, because they have no idea what the like domino effect of their work should look like.
Right.
Find people who actually know what they're doing on both sides of the coin, which is kind of trying to find a needle in a haystack, but obviously they exist. You have a whole team full of them.
Yeah.
Hire also, Danielle.
Yeah, thank you. That's the thing too, with like, I keep seeing these tweets about like, oh, the future of B2B social and B2B content are TikTokers or influencers. That's not true.
They only think that marketing equals social media.
Yeah, right, and like, it's not. And also, like, I've been working with some of these TikTokers just through Snapchat. Like, we have to collaborate with them as influencers. And to be honest, I've had to rewrite every single one of their scripts to make it work as an ad.
Right.
When you are hiring a TikToker or something, you are not hiring them for their creativity. You're not hiring them for their marketing expertise. You're hiring them for their trust, mm-hmm. because they have an audience who they have trust with, and you are basically buying that audience. And so don't hire a TikToker to make a paid Facebook ad for you, because that's not going to compute. Hire a TikToker because you want to post a video on their actual TikTok page.
Right.
Big difference.
Wow. I never really thought about that. I think it's hard because so much of our world now is marketing and like is that influencer culture and like whatever and content creation. Yeah. But like the word content creation is thrown around very loosely.
Totally.
Like I'm creating content every day when I post on my Instagram story. That doesn't mean that I should be running your Instagram page.
Yeah, very different things.
No. Yeah, 100%.
Specifically not me.
Couldn't be me. How do you have those kind of like hard conversations with clients? Like as someone who may not be a, for example, 50-year-old white male executive.
I just don't let it faze me. I just, anyone who would be off put by my age or gender or how I appear is not the right fit for us. I also think like, to also part of it is the endorsement of 50-year-old white males, right? Mm. So like, you know, like Dave is constantly talking about me on Twitter and LinkedIn and endorsing me. And I think I've been able to use the trust of those older guys that are established in a way where, okay, other people in the industry go, okay, she knows what she's doing. And mm-hmm. so I can kind of go into these meetings and say things exactly like how I'm talking to you guys right now. And I say this, I'll say these things and I'll say it with full confidence because it's the truth.
Yeah.
And it works, right? So they put it into action and it works. And well, so I think that's what matters. And I also, yeah.
It helps to be real. Like, and I think that that's something that we're going to learn maybe in the next 2 to 5 years is there's going to be a lot more smaller niche agencies that know exactly what they're doing that are just like, and I guess my question now, we glamorize it as like, you get to pick your own clients and you get to do all this stuff. And like, there is a piece of that, but I also wonder like, how much is that actually true? And what you're telling me, it actually sounds like you just won't put up with anybody that you don't want to work with or anybody that doesn't fully believe in what you do or your vision for it. Or like, you're not a video production company that somebody could send you a script and say, this is what we want you to build.
And like you can, but to be honest, the ones that we're attracting and the ones that want to do that aren't going to, they're going to go on Fiverr and get someone for $200 or they're going to get a shitty
and they're going to get that back.
Yeah. And you get what you pay for in that sense. And so even just, we'll say, look, our pricing point starts at this. If you don't have this, then, you know, I recommend you try something else in the meantime.
That's where the magic happens, is like letting your team decide what's best for that business, I guess.
Totally.
Have you ever felt, or like, especially in the beginning when you were like defining that pricing? I think, I know for me, I literally bought an electric toothbrush this morning because I love my dental hygienist and I didn't want to say no to her. It stresses me out having those kinds of pricing conversations. Did you ever learn the hard way of like taking a contract for less value than you think it should have been worth? Just in general, there, we talk about being okay with failing and that's how you learn. But the stakes are a little bit lower when we're looking out for ourselves versus when you're responsible for other people and like their kind of livelihoods.
I think I did make a lot, and I'm still working on this. Like I'm still figuring it out. I think I've made a lot of mistakes scaling. I put way too much on myself. I don't delegate enough. I've even made mistakes with, I know like a few months ago, I hired someone to do something and like she delivered a bunch of stuff back and it just wasn't what I needed. And she spent way too long doing it. And I ended up paying her hourly and I lost a lot of money from it. Things like that. And I'm still working on that. I think the biggest thing is scaling. It's like, okay, how do I take my brain and scale it? And I think part of that is saying, okay, I need to maybe not try to do that and say, okay, let's find people with different strengths and that maybe aren't my strengths or the things that I maybe don't enjoy doing and give that to them. And also part of that too, right, is the type of business we accept, right? Is, okay, maybe like something we're focusing on now is we want to do less, but better. And so like more of those bigger comedic brand style videos versus like taking on 20 more clients that want little social clips.
Yeah.
Like I can scale the social clip thing, but it's a matter of, I don't actually think I want to.
Yeah.
And that's something that's a hard thing that I needed to kind of figure out these past few weeks, to be honest.
That's huge though.
Yeah. So things like that.
That's boundary setting. That's expectation setting. That's mm-hmm. being like, that's not what we're good at. Or like, we can do that, but like, that's not what I want to spend my time on.
And the tough thing too, right, is, and this has been sort of the difference for me between delegating and prioritizing working at a company versus having clients and running an agency style thing, is there's no cap on my income. And like, there isn't. And so like, working at a company, you can say, oh, I don't think I have time for this project. Can we push it back to next month? But when you have 20 clients saying, hey, here's a bunch of money, make stuff, it's hard. I struggled with saying no, and I'm still working on that, to the clients, just because it's just like, okay, but it means more money. When you're at a company, it's like, okay, my salary is the same regardless of what I do. So I'm just going to, it's easier to prioritize that way.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very easy to work 80 hours a week if you're going to be paid for 80 hours of work a week, right?
Yeah. And I think the biggest thing is like, it's something that I'm working on this week with our mental health week, is like, it's not about money all the time. Like, it doesn't need to be. It can be more about, okay, what do we actually enjoy? I was experiencing something this year where like work was starting to make me anxious. Like I had so many projects and I was like, okay, which projects are making me anxious and why? Like, what am I actually enjoying? And what am I not enjoying? How do I delegate what I'm not enjoying to other people? How do I scale down on the work that I'm not enjoying it, and the team as a whole is not enjoying, and scale up on the stuff that the team really loves to do?
Yeah. And that shows in the work too. The things that you love to do are going to be better. You're going to want to put more time in. You're going to, all of those things. So,
yeah. And I think they add more value for companies, right? That big brand video, even if you're spending, you know, 20 to 50 grand on it, you're going to get a lot out of that, because it's going to make you stand out and it's going to be fun. And I think that creativity and that passion and enjoyment comes through in the piece itself.
But I think that that's important, a distinction even of like working for yourself versus working for a company. Like I can come with projects to whatever until the cows come home. And like, if my boss doesn't think that it's useful, then like, we're not going to do it. And then I'm like, yeah, well, that sucks, you know? And it's kind of like, that's how it goes. But then I also only have to work 40 hours a week. So the trade-off.
But I think saying no to the things that you may be good at but hate doing versus saying yes, like that initial change is really hard. Like I had a friend who did sales, didn't like it, was like literally like physically stressed all the time, and tried to transition to design. But that whole time that she was making that career move from sales to design, she was getting bombarded by recruiters offering her sales jobs. And it would be so easy to just take the job that you know you'd be good at, but be miserable and not follow that path of like, but I actually really want to do this. Yeah. Like I'm good at running your company's social and community. It physically sucks the life out of me. And I actually am not super productive when I do it, versus like, I want to be in a project management role where I'm delegating and get to guide people to a final product. And I'm so much more productive when I do things like that.
Yeah.
I think like, that's a really hard decision to make. And it takes a lot of maturity and also like self-control.
Oh, yes. But I think more than that, I think it's, those things can be okay for you at a certain point in your career. And you're an anomaly because you're 24 and already doing the damn thing. But like for me, I used to love to execute. I used to love to get a lot of enjoyment because it was like, boom, boom, boom. I know how to do this. And getting those reps was really important for me early in my career. But now I'm like, I know how to do that. It doesn't bring me the same joy. And I like get upset with myself because I'm like, why? You're good at that. Like, why would you not like doing that anymore? And I'm like, but my brain, like, because it's growth, because I'm like learning.
That's exactly it.
I'm just too hard on myself is really what it is.
Anyway.
Anyways.
I think One thing that's super interesting is you have a really cool position of kind of experiencing some of the more later on in your career moments, like hiring a team and like dealing with clients and business development and like business strategy.
Yeah.
That was the word. Are those conventional wisdom tropes that people love to talk about of like hire people better than you, like no. Are there some that you think are like complete bullshit now that you're actually going through? Like spill some
tea. We need the knowledge.
So like yes and no. First of all, when it comes to strategy, I feel like my approach is unconventional and it works. A lot of people just don't know. No one knows how to do video strategy. And I think with Drift and with a lot of the clients that I've been working with, it's just something we've sort of figured out throughout the process. And like, we've seen the data, we've seen what's actually working. It's a lot of it is to that gut feeling, right? Of like, okay, this is clearly working. This got 19,000 additional followers for our client. So this clearly is good. This is very boring and this is structured incorrectly and no one's engaging with it. This is bad. And so that's a big part of it. You're not going to learn that at an MBA. I don't have an MBA. I studied movies. My degree is in film and theater.
So amazing.
Never studied marketing. I got my MBA from working with Dave Gerhart. In terms of hiring, that's hard. My biggest thing is, here's the biggest thing. I think a lot of people say, don't have an emotional friendship sort of relationship with the people that you work with. That's the fully opposite of our entire team. Our team, yeah. We're all very close.
Yeah.
We spend time together, whether we're working or we're not. And I've found that it's actually good. Obviously, there needs to be lines and boundaries set on certain things. And it needs to be the right group of people, right? It can't be mm-hmm. someone who's going to be, there can't be any petty people involved. There can't be people who are going to take things personally. But the great thing, right, is like if someone's having a day where they're feeling anxious or if they're going through something, we can talk about it with each other right. And we can say, oh, like you're having an anxious day. That's totally fine. I'm going to take this project on for you.
Right.
And you go take the day and rest. Or if I'm having a day where it's like, I'm not okay this week. Can I get some help? And they're there to help. So that's
right,
a big thing.
Because you're open about it.
Yeah. And I think that's huge. Just people are like, well, don't get emotional with your employees. Don't. And I disagree with that. I think that putting people first and making sure everyone knows that they're seen and cared about is important. And even just asking people, what do you like, I make sure to check in with everyone that I work with, right? And like, okay, are you doing what you're actually enjoying? Has that changed? Tell me. And right. We'll find something else for you to do if that's not it.
That's maybe a super benefit to having your own thing, because you're an amazing person and you're going to surround yourself with amazing people. Like, I don't know how big your team is, but that's so hard to scale. Like, I think right now B2B companies are trying to get that same level of authenticity with 70 people that are so different from each other that it's like, there's no way that's possible. So like, why are we trying to make fetch happen?
Yeah. And that's why I don't want a 70 person team. Like, I don't want to manage 70 people. I don't want to do that. I like the structure that I have now, honestly, of here's my team of people. They're all super talented.
I think it's dope that you went from working for others to like working for yourself, but you're still always working a little bit like for other people when you have like clients. How does getting feedback from a manager differ from getting feedback from a client? And how is it taken both emotionally, but also in your work?
Feedback from a manager, like I got very close with my manager at Drift. I knew her feedback style. With clients, it's just every client is going to be different with their feedback. I've really learned to set clear expectations about what they're going to be receiving with clients. A lot of it is communication, right? And just really over-communicating. This is the process. This is what it's going to look like. This is how long it's going to take. This is how it's going to go. This is what feedback is going to look like. I have feedback worked into contracts at this point, you know, because we're not going to do 20 rounds of feedback because you decided that you wanted to change your idea completely.
Oh, hell no.
Yeah. I also, you can change your idea just to pay us for another project. Also, that's the thing is like every client's going to be different too. And that's like the bigger the brand, the more bureaucracy there's going to be. And so there's going to be 10 different voices that want different things. And so that always becomes a factor. And you just have to not, you can't take it personally. You have to know, like, okay. And that's actually the great thing about, I've worked on a marketing team. So I know that it's not personal. And I know it's like, okay, here's what happened at the marketing team meeting. They're not critiquing me. They're critiquing the piece, and they have these goals, and they have these weird brand guidelines and these arbitrary things that they need included. And that's often what feedback ends up being, right? Is that. I also want to put this out there, like, working for yourself or running an agency, it's really not for everybody. Like, I don't recommend that everyone do this. I feel like everyone's like, be an entrepreneur or do this. It's not for everybody, and it shouldn't be.
Do you think, so when you get feedback from a manager, it generally impacts the way that you think about doing that thing again? And it kind of like changes the way that you would scope a project. Do you have that sort of same feedback loop from your clients where like the feedback ends up actually being constructive and you sort of change the whole way that you think about a video like that or like video production in general? How often is that feedback like that valuable?
Not often.
How difficult is that to then like try and get better at your craft?
Yeah. So sometimes it is valuable. It's usually the little things that really build up into, I've made thousands of videos and gotten little pieces of feedback. And I think it's those little pieces of feedback that compound and have and make me better at my craft on the day to day is really what it is, versus when I was at Drift and first learning things, it was like, oh, this is a big thing that's going to shape how I do things. I think I'm past the point in my career where it's like, this project is going to shape how I do things, versus each little project is going to have its own piece of learning. And that compounded learning is going to be
Where my experience too that you can go back and look at and be like, oh, I have encountered this type of feedback before or whatever it is.
We're going to talk about cheese real fast because I think this is very important that we do that.
Yeah. So please tell me about the kind of cheese you have in your fridge. Very interested.
Yes. So I almost always have mozzarella in my fridge. Perfect. I'm a big mozzarella eater. I think it's a classic. I think everyone needs a little mozzarella in their life.
I agree.
Lately, I've been really into goat cheese.
My girl. That's my favorite.
Trying to eat healthier, so I've been making salads, but I don't think salads should exist without goat cheese in them.
Yeah. I agree wholeheartedly.
I think I'm going to have to send you a couple salad recipes with goat cheese in them. Wait, but tell us what's in the salad with the goat cheese.
Yeah. So I put in my goat cheese salad, I have mostly goat cheese, spinach, because you need that in the salad, and that's the point, unfortunately. Then I cut up strawberries because I really like strawberries. I'm a sweet tooth type of person. Mm-hmm. I use strawberries, and then I also do like walnuts and like a raspberry type of vinaigrette dressing.
Killing it.
Go on top.
Amazing.
That's like very springy.
Yeah.
But also can be wintry. It's an all season salad.
Yeah. My one salad hack, I will say, is two kinds of lettuce, no matter what kind of salad it is. You need to have two kinds of lettuce.
Okay. Noted.
No.
Yeah.
Danielle, it was amazing chatting with you. Thank you so much for spending the time bringing your four cats into this recording and just like making us want to be you. Make sure to leave us a review if you really liked it. Okay. Love you. Bye.
Okay. Love you. Bye.